We are holding by Shabtat Tzvi. That's in our, you know, we're like trying to get up to date or up to where we want to really hold. Shabtat Tzvi, the whole story of Shabtat Tzvi is without any question, the key event of Jewish history in the 1600s. And without almost any question, completely changed Ashkenazi history. Without a question, Sephardi, it's like sort of like fascinating that non-Ashkenazi Jewish history was not as unsettled by Shabtai Tzvi, which is not 100% clear why. But that's like how it is. Okay, the key. Researcher, scholar of Shabtai Tzvi, as you may be aware, is Gershon Shalom. No, Professor Gershon Shalom of the Hebrew University. He died about, let's say, 30, 35 years ago. Actually, when I was saying on it 2 years ago, I discussed it with Rabbi Meir for some reasons or another. And he told me that Reb Tzvi Cook was once at a bris, at a brit milah, and Gershon Shalom was invited also. And he refused to look him in the face or say hello to him. So, Reb Tzvi Cook? Reb Cook. And his son was Reb Tzvi Cook, Reb Tzvi Yehuda Cook. He nifter in Paris approximately 1981, something like that. Anyway, Gershon Shalom is the key scholar. And for whatever reasons, what's your name again?
Ralph.
As I point out to Ralph, I don't clearly understand why, but when I was wicking through things a little bit, I noticed that Wikipedia, for whatever funny reasons, goes with Gretz. Heinrich Gretz? I think that's his first name, Heinrich, is what it feels like. Gretz was a German Jewish, like, not like traditional, not Mamish Reform, but certainly not Orthodox Jewish historian. And he is like the father of secular Jewish history. And that's just how it is. So they go with Gretz. And Gershon Shalom revised much of Gretz's conclusions. Contemporary academia goes with Gershon Shalom over Gretz, without a question. As we go on, I'll try to give you a couple of examples to show you the differences. And there's a reason why I personally would side more with Gershon Shalom than with Gretz. I mean, whatever. Neither one, whatever. Anyway, okay. Okay, now, the background's like this, and this is interesting. Gershon Shalom has like a 100-page essay, piece on this, in which he like absolutely proves that he's not. I mean, he was not born religious at all. It's not like even people born religious have become not religious at a relatively young age. A lot of times, like forget what it was really like, if you understand. So, Gershon Shalom is just absolutely unaware that believing in Mashiach is a key part of the Jewish religion. And it's not the Rambam didn't invent it, and this didn't invent it, and that didn't invent it. He's doing what I classically call an autopsy as opposed to examining a live patient. We did that one once this year? Maybe once? We want to go over it again? Okay. There's a difference between when you... people who are real outsiders in terms of Judaism, in a practical sense, when they're trying to examine something, like... Chassidus is a very popular thing for academia to examine. They have a technical challenge and issue that they're viewing Chassidus from a laboratory perspective and trying like a dead body and performing an autopsy. And they don't take into account. I mean, Chassidus is first of all not even that old. I mean, the entire Chassidus started 250 years ago, approximately. 60, 70 years ago, not much more than that. And as a result of that, you can come to very erroneous conclusions. I mean, let me just give you an example, which no one argues about, but it's just an example and more like mainline things. The first complete you know, the first complete siddur is from Reb Sadiga. Now, that doesn't mean anything, of course, because the Mishnah refers to the siddur and to many tefillahs as like a known document which everyone has. And according to what I call standard Judaism, the siddur was invented by the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. There's obviously not many siddurim left because Jews don't buy siddurim to put in libraries, rather they buy siddurim to use them. Right? I mean, you understand that's a technical problem. So the fact that I can't technically access a documented siddur from the year, from 2,000 years ago, that doesn't prove anything. There are. I don't think anyone contests. It's hard to know. I could hear either way. I could, you know, I know enough about. I've seen enough and know enough. I could hear either way. But this is sort of like there are places where they will, like, here. Let me give you a different example. See this. And this is just a very technical biographical point. But it's just like it's like funny. It's like, listen, according to everything we know, Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech of Lezhensk were brothers. I don't know if you know anything about Chassidus. Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech of Lezhensk were brothers, and there's a lot of lore, Chassidic legend, some of it, you know, real, and some of it, I mean, whatever. Let's not get into what is real in Chassidus or not. I don't want to, you know what they say in Yiddish? An Chassidus a masim afreknish concautious. That means on Hasidic stories we don't ask questions. Yet, there still is a difference between something that people were saying, you know, something documented from pre-1900 and post-1900. You know, if the first time this story has been ever printed was in 1985, then I'm much more skeptical about the, you know, authenticity of the story than a story which is, was set over 100 years ago, you know, pre-1900 approximately. I accept basically as a true story. I mean, whatever, you know. The Chassidim themselves say that you can't, whoever believes all the stories is a fool. I mean, what do you say? What do you want out of me? They say whoever believes all the stories is a fool. Whoever doesn't believe any of the stories is an epicurus. That's what they say. Okay, I don't know, whatever, I don't know. That's what the Chassidim say. Wait, yeah, okay, tough. So, it's true there's no technical documentation to prove that Reb Zusha of Anapoli and Reb Elimelech of Lezhensk were brothers. That's true. But that's not difficult. The Chafetz Chaim didn't have a birth certificate either. The Chafetz Chaim died in 1933. He was born in 1837, died in 1933, and famously he wanted to go to the first Aguda convention in Austria. He needed a passport. So they said, where's your birth certificate? So it's a birth certificate. I was born in this little shtetl in 1837. There's no birth certificates then. He said, okay, very good. So bring two witnesses who could testify that you were born in that city. He said, you know, he's an 80-year-old man. Who's left alive who remembers my birth? So eventually they made up a way to give him a passport. But anyway, but kids, so the point is that lack of documentation when there should be documentation proves something. The lack of documentation when there is no reason there should be documentation doesn't prove anything. Anyway, that was a divergence just to show what when we're talking about so if I have like a living Masorah of something, so I will give that, being who I am, I will give that real, you know, mamshus, real, you know, real significance, etc. They're total outsiders, and they're viewing Chassidus as a dead body, etc. So they're like doing an autopsy on it. So this is a similar thing to Yav Gershon Shalom, who has no belief at all in Mashiach. So he starts out his book with a long thing about views of Mashiach, and he's trying to say, show how it changed, etc. Backs and forth. And the Rambam, and this, it's not, you're, listen, believing Mashiach is a very key central part of the Jewish religion. It was not invented by Rishonim. It was not invented by this. It's part of, it's in Tanakh, repetitively from Chumash, throughout Tanakh, throughout Midrashim, etc. Now, it's true. Now, I'm going to step back and tell you that I'm not the one who says it's Rabbi Yitzhak Kutner. We know who Rabbi Yitzhak Kutner was? No, Rabbi Kutner? Chaim Berlin? Rashiva Chaim Berlin? Okay. He says that one of the things that Shabtai Tzvi completely changed was the way Jews look at the Pius Mashiach. and maybe we'll go back over that as we go through the story, or basically when we basically finish the story. But the point is even though on one hand I value Gershon Shalom as a very professional historian, very, very professional. The work, his book on Shabtai Tzvi, is like 900 pages. Well done, well documented. When he not only documents where he comes from, but he's relatively good about sourcing it and showing why he came to his conclusions from his sources and his footnotes. Of course, like every other historian, he does not print every single document. And I read a work by a very Haredi person on it, who did. He was very selective in what he brought. But he still, there are things which he brings, and he wrote, let's say, like 150 pages on Shabtai Tzvi. Gershon Shalom wrote like 900 pages. So in his 150 pages, he still brings quotes from documents that Gershon Shalom ignored because they don't really work with his theory. It depends on different points. Well, that was like my preface to the whole Shabtai Tzvi, to the Shabtai Tzvi issues. So I'd basically go with Gershon Shalom plus minus. That's my approach with Shabtai Tzvi. I go Gershon Shalom plus minus. I didn't have time, of course, to do all the original research. I'm not, whatever, you know what I mean? I did this in my, it's one class, it's one sweet class here in Torah Shraga, you know, I'm not, like, you know. Anyway, okay. Okay, the connection. One of Gershon Shalom's big theories is that the Shabtai Tzvi episode is coming b'ikvus Arizal, because of the Arizal, etc., etc. His Moshe Ido, etc. The present, all the professors of Kabbalah of Kabbalah in Israeli universities today are all students of Gershon Shalom, and they basically argue with him based on the basic idea, that the Ari's Ksavim did not hit the world at large until the mid-1700s. So 1720s, 1730s, earliest they hit the world. Until then, and then I actually spoke to someone I know, whatever, let's not get all the details, if you're really interested, I'll tell you who it is later. And he said, yeah, it's true. The Kisvei Ari were basically unknown to the world. So they were not printed in any form at all until the 1720s approximately. I revise back though and say that may be true. I'm not going to dispute that, but what I will dispute is the Arizal was known as a figure. In other words, it's true that a lot of the details of Kabbalas Ari, not a lot, almost all the details of Kabbalas Ari were not known to, quote, the world at large, to the Jewish world at large. But the accomplishment of the Ari was known, and he certainly was a known figure, etc., etc., etc. And he was known and respected and revered, and all those things are all true. And there was a lot of, I'm not sure, it's hard to prove this one way or the other, how much the statement that quotes, the Reb Chaim Vital says on the Ri, I don't remember if the statement is the Ri was Mashiach ben Yosef or could have been Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay. Either way, I believe it's very possible that these ideas and statements were known to a larger, a larger public. Even though, again, the details I agree weren't known, but the general idea that there is accomplishment in Kabbalah was very important, and that it's like Mashiach maybe coming any moment in a real way. I would say that it's possible those ideas were known. That's what I would say. Okay. Cha 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 cha. Okay. Okay. Shabtai Tzvi. Let's get down to Tachlis now. He's born in 1626 in a city which Jews call Izmir. How is our geography, guys? Middle Eastern geography. Horrible. Okay. Here, let's see. Let's see how good of a job. Should I try? Should I try or not?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try. Is there anything better than these markers here? How are these markers?
Do you speed read when you read? You know how to?
Yes, of course I know how to. Let's see, how does that do it? That's pretty good. Okay. Here, let's make an attempt. at geography. That's not so great, but it's good enough for our purposes. Okay, Turkey. Okay, you see where Turkey is? Egypt is right here. Nile. The Egypt is Nile, and Nile is Egypt. That's what the English used to say. Israel. I'm not making, I'm just, you know, approximations here. That's not big enough. Israel's going to have to be this big if this is our Lebanon. Syria. Aleppo. Khalab. Two cities near each other in Syria.
Khalab
is next to Aleppo. Plus minus, I'm pretty sure.
I thought that was the whole area.
I'm pretty sure that's how it is. Okay, anyway. Okay, now, where's Izmir? Izmir is right here. It's actually on the coast.
Great city?
Medium large. Smyrna. Izmir in English is called Smyrna. Okay, now, this is Greece. Constantinople's right here. Gallipoli's right here. Adrianople's like right over there, whatever. Okay, that gets us. We basically feel like we have a good geographical framework now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Shabtai Tzvi is born here in Izmir. Izmir is a very, very typical, city on the Mediterranean basin, which means it has locals plus a lot of Sephardim. Shabtai Tzvi was 100% Yotzei Sephard. 100%. He even spoke Ladino. That's how much of a Yotzei Sephard he was. As he even spoke Ladino. The rabbinic, I don't know the numbers in Izmir. I didn't see like a really like well done monograph, as you would call it, on it. So I can't tell you what the percentages were. There were a lot of Yotzei Sephard in Izmir. Shabtai Tzvi's family themselves were merchants, which is a great job for Yotzei Sephard, because they have all the, here, this is Italy here. They have the Yotzei Sephard, again, between the Yotzei Sephard and the Portuguese Jews, they have connections here, 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 here. Italy. Amsterdam's way up there. And then they have some of their cousins who still didn't revert to Judaism in Spain and Portugal helping them out also. that was like the network, the Sephardi network. They were all well connected, and Shabtai Tzvi's father was a real Yotzi. He was not Portuguese. He was a Sephard. He was someone who must have left Spain. The family either left Spain in 1391 or 1492. Chup. When he was born, famously on. No, when do you think he was born? Take one guess. What?
No,
which day of the year? No. No, better. Come on, no.
December 23rd.
No. No, Jewish, guys, come on. Tisha B'Av. Right? Mashiach is supposed to be born on Tisha B'Av, right? And Shabtai Tzvi was born on Tisha B'Av. Yeah, okay, whatever. His brothers followed their father in family business. He himself was of a intellectual / learned ascetic type nature, so he was in yeshiva. And he did relatively well. He was quite part of. Let's just step back briefly. Today, in the world at large, generally speaking, people, certainly at 18, 19 years old, are not learning Kabbalah. I mean, I had a guy recently, not this year, whatever, and said, "No, what are we going to learn tonight?" I said, "Rabbi, let's learn Kabbalah." I said, "You're in Shana Aleph, no Kabbalah." Okay, but, and, you know, in standard yeshivas, even in Hasidic yeshivas, they don't, real intense Kabbalah, they don't do until their people are more developed. But back in the old days, it wasn't like that. This is one of the major differences, you know, like seismic differences between pre-Shaptai Tzvi and post-Shaptai Tzvi. And again, ironically, it's more true amongst Ashkenazim than Sephardim. But even amongst Sephardim, you usually don't have 18-year-olds attempting to learn Kabbalah. You don't. Now, part of it, part of learning Kabbalah is asceticism, is prishut, is separating yourself from Olam Hazeh, and that very much appealed to Shabtai Tzvi. That very much appeared to Shabtai Tzvi. Let's see what else we need to know here. Okay, now, this is a major point of Gershon Shalom's, which I hold he's 100% right about. I mean, 100%. I hold he's... it's hard to believe he's wrong. Let me rephrase that one. He has a lot of continued documentation to it. And it sort of goes like this. His basic theory is that Shabtai Tzvi, before 1665, the key year of Shabtai Tzvi is 1665, summer 65 to summer 66. That is the key year. It's about 14 months of the year of Shabtai Tzvi. That, those are the key events, and everything happens in that year, and whatever. I mean, everything local around Shabtai Tzvi. The earthquake to the Jewish world at large, as we say, we're still suffering from today. Anyway, so pre-1665, he was not really, he didn't have a movement. And it's true that a number of the people who later joined his movement had known him earlier. And it's true that one of the basic biographical facts about Shabtai Tzvi is that he had, quotes, magnetic personality, charismatic magnetic personality. This is true. That as they say, everyone agrees to that. Even his greatest opponents agreed that he had a very charming, charming personality, charming magnetic personality. But the facts are, Gretz, and if you look in Wikipedia, it goes straight with Gretz, puts it together, Ki'ilu, like Shabtai Tzvi was like planning this from his youth, and, you know, and he built up from one stage to another and makes it sound like that's what happened. That is not, there's no, you know, the nuts and bolts of historical research is you need contemporary documentation. That means a document written basically when the event happened. When a document is not written when the event happened, then it is suspect. And certainly when the level of passion that Shabtai Tzvi aroused in people, they're definitely right to be suspicious, to be very suspicious of the fact that all the people who claim they were his followers from very early, there's no documentation. They only document that post-1665. There's nothing written from them pre-1665. And if, in fact, they held Shabtai Tzvi was really Mashiach before that, then L'chara, they should have written something down. Because once he became what we call public news, everyone was writing down about the guy. You don't understand, there's three basic sources of Shabtai Tzvi information. There's the what they call the believers, the maminim, the kofrim. You understand what that means? Kofra means heretics, ki'ilu. So there's those who believe in him, there's those who deny him, and then there's non-Jewish sources also. Those are the three, what? There's no documentation of Shabtai Tzvi having any following pre-1665. So therefore, based on that, Gershon Shalom rejects Gretz's theories, where Gretz wants to like make it out that Shabtai Tzvi started out small in Izmir and built up later, and it was a whole clear process, and Gershon Shalom just tosses that right out the window. And it says, just not true. Even the people Some of the details are like too minute to go through, and they're like, we're just trying to zip through it this week and next week. They're like, you ever read Avner Gold? You know who Avner Gold is? He wrote books like 20, 30 years ago, like historical novels. He goes with Goretz also for some reason. I actually know, it's not his real name, I actually know who he is. He's probably not holding it, as they say. But some of the very famous stories are most likely, complete fiction. Anyway, yeah, how's that for a dangle? Okay. The key things like this, and I'm not 100% sure of this, but no one is, but I'm going to go with it anyway. Does anyone here know what bipolar really means?
I don't know what it means at all.
Yeah, please. That's right, we did.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, Benji, I'm impressed. So what's bipolar? Are you going to review it for us now? Well, Shaul was not, that's right, we did discuss this night later. Shaul was not, but there's no, from Tanakh, I would say, I don't believe Shaul was not bipolar. That would be an insult to Shaul, and I wouldn't say it at all. Shabtai Tzvi, the mainline approach is he was bipolar. Someone who's bipolar has three states: manic, depressive, and normal. Those are the three states. Today, which means in the last, when Gershon Shalom wrote the book, he originally wrote it in Hebrew in the 50s, translated into English in the 60s. They still had no real treatment for bipolarism. Even though it was clearly documented what it is, documented by psychiatrists what it is, it still was not really, it was understood but not controllable. Today, you could Wikipedia this to find out what, but they did develop medicines to control bipolarism. And minimally in the last 20 years, if not even 30, bipolarism, maybe it's even 40, bipolarism has been treatable. Okay, so now let me just try to explain what bipolarism is. Let's do depressive, because it's a little easier to understand than manic. But a person who's bipolar is depressed. Let's say you have a regular person who's depressed. Okay, so you say, Shmerel, it's not so terrible. Things are going to get better. And if you'll what we call, give them chizik, or if you're a professional, you charge them a lot of money and you give them therapy. No, there is something to therapy. I know my father's a rocket scientist, and rocket scientists aren't sure if doctors are really doing real science. And doctors certainly don't believe that psychologists are doing something real. But okay, Lamaisa they are. Okay, Lamaisa they are and they aren't all at the same time. It's a little more complicated. They do help people. Nothing to talk about it. But it's a honed form of chizik. That's what it really is. That's what it really is. Okay. If someone is psychologically depressed, if you know them well and you know the process, you could teach them how to view themselves in a better way, and you can get them, quotes, out of their depression and they'll be fine. When someone is bipolar, in a state, depressive state, you cannot talk them out of it. It's like they have like a black lens over them, a chemically induced black lens in their body, tinging everything negative. And the moment you could talk to them and maybe convince them, you could do a little bit of therapy and it will work maybe for like a minute or 5 minutes. The second they walk out of your office, you take their check and put it in the bank, they go right back to where they were. That is what bipolar, it's a chemical state in the body. It is not just a state in the mind.
Is that clinical depression?
I'm not sure of clinical depression. I'm not sure. Okay, anyway. McKitzer. No, clinical depression, I don't think so. I think clinical depression, I'm not sure. I hope I never have to deal with this. But, whatever, let's not worry about that. Well, let's just go through bipolarism quickly. Okay, fine. So the other state of bipolarism is manic. And like someone who's manic will also have, instead of a black lens over their eyes, they'll have a rosy lens over their eyes. And, let's say they're a basketball player, let's say they're an average high school basketball player. Or, no, you know what? A well above average Jewish high school basketball player. They will think that they're headed to the NBA. You understand? I mean, that's like, that is bipolarism. I mean, they might be very good, you know. They might be the greatest player, one of the top players in all the Jewish schools, but you ain't headed to the NBA guy. You're not close to it. But if they're manic, they would think they are. Okay? Fine. I mean, look, you know, I don't have to tell you that we know, you know, Kiilu sports fans could still give you long lists of people who at a lower level, who at a college level did great, and then the pros didn't go anywhere. Right? Okay, we need to, whatever. I'm sure we get a sports fan here. We could go, yeah, this one and that one and this one and that one and this. A lot of people. At a college level, they were unbelievable. They did unbelievable things on the field, but you can put them on the pro level, they don't go anywhere. So that, but if you were manic, Kiilu, they would think they're as good as anyone in the NFL. I mean, they do when they're in college. Okay, no, they're not manic at that state. They're just out of touch with complete reality. Yeah, anyway, okay, tough. So, yeah, okay. Fight. Sort of like this, though. Now, Shabtai Tzvi was, even though he was, you know, learned, and Ki'ilu, if he wouldn't have had all of his problems, we would call him Talmud Chacham, he was also Ki'ilu, very deeply interested in Kabbalah, and Kabbalah Maisis, and practical Kabbalah. So therefore, when he went manic, the way it affected him was he thought that all these Kabbalistic ideas, which are true about Mashiach, apply to him.
He was born on Tisha B'Av.
He was born on Tisha B'Av, etc., etc., etc. Okay, now, one of his manic delusions, while still in Smyrna, by saying, you know, let's roll back before we get there. So he was again, he was into the Kabbalah and very much a parush, very much an ascetic, so much so that he was married twice, and had to give a get because he refused to consummate the marriage.
Two times.
Okay. Now. So around that period, he was like he had some people again. He had a charming character and a charismatic character, and to someone who doesn't know anything, you could think that he is really something. So he had some followers. So he was like he's like telling them, okay, we're gonna do something really really important today. He was in a manic state, and he was like, you know, meditating on the pasuk. Allah Bamasi of, which literally means I will go above the, make my high place above, just wait a second, above the clouds. And he delusionally thought that he was like floating in the air. Which is a classic piece of manic psychosis. Yeah.
So also, the last time I said that he actually believed that he was a Mashiach.
We'll get there in a moment. We'll get to the first part of it today, but let's just keep going. Now, why was he throwing? He was throwing his basic Shabtai Tzvi pattern up till 1665 is like this. He comes to a city. I mean, he started out in Izmir, and he did know something. And he was, when he was normal, he looked like a spiritual person, like a holy person. So he has a certain amount of respect by the Jewish community. But then he goes manic, he does wild things, and they throw him out. What got him thrown out of his hometown is he called his Talmidim together, and he said, we are going to do meditations and stop the sun like Yehoshua. Well, what can I tell you? It didn't work. They tried, and it didn't work. And he told his Talmidim, you know why it didn't work? It's because you, the Talmidim, did not reach the proper level of Taira, of purity and Kedusha and of holiness. And that's why it didn't work. Okay, so the rabbis and Smyrna hear about it, and they say, Mr. Tzvi, you are a threat to society. Out. Now there are people who quote them as saying that they thought of killing him. hard to know, you know, the person who says that was Saptatsu's greatest, most bitter enemy. And I don't agree with all of Shalom Gershon Shalom's critique of Rabbi Yaakov Sospartus, but some of it I definitely hear. I understand why he says that. So, whatever. So, I don't know. They did want to kill him. They didn't want to kill him. I don't know. Okay. Okay. So now he goes on his travels. He was definitely made it to Constantinople, which again, if we look at our map, makes of course a lot of sense. And here, just wait a second, let's add in something else to our map. Constantinople. He definitely made it to Constantinople, he definitely made it to Salonika, and he definitely made it back to Alexandria. He made it all of these places. And it's all the same pattern. So he goes through the same pattern, he comes in, he gets a nice welcome, he's someone who knows something, he could talk to you in learning, you know. There was no, it's like we have to project backwards. Not only were there no cell phones, there were no phones. There were no telegraphs. How did people know? It wasn't really nice. In other words, someone would have to have been considered a tremendous threat for the Rabbanim from one place to send out letters to everyone else. There's this guy coming, beware, he is dangerous. They didn't view him as dangerous. Like the Rambam says, someone who claims his Mashiach is probably crazy. Right? Okay, so he's a harmless threat, probably a harmless threat at most. And there was no clear pre-1665, he's not viewed as a major threat by anybody. So he does his rounds, he comes into the city, he knows something, he seems to be holy, he positive influence on some people. So what's the problem exactly? But then he goes manic and does something wild. Like in Salonika, he famously tells everyone he's getting married. Do you know who he marries this time?
Shulitz.
What?
Shulitz.
No. Think more conceptual. Makes a whole chasna, invites everyone. And he marries the Sefer Torah. Okay. Besides marrying a Sefer Torah, he does all sorts of wild, he buys the orange fish and puts it in a baby carriage and claims it's all sorts of tikkun. Yosef Pastelnik. I don't think you guys didn't quite cross paths. He was Sean Bellinger. He says, yeah, well, he married a Sefer Torah. That's why his baby was a fish. Yeah, anyway, the kitzer. It's the same pattern. It goes over and over. And that's the years of Shabtai Tzvi's wanderings. That's what they're marked by. Now, he makes his way eventually to Alexandria. Now, in Alexandria, something very, very important happens. There was a person whose name was Raphael Yosef. Wait, that's not your last name, though, is it?
That's my first name.
Raphael Yosef is his family name. I understood. He was called the Ghibli. Do we know what Ghibli means? No. Okay. Ghibli. He was He was the head of the Jewish community. He was in charge of the port and the finances of the Egypt. Was a quasi-independent province in the Ottoman Empire. And he was a major macher in terms of running the finances of the entire Egypt. Very well-to-do Jew.
Just like Yosef.
Very well-to-do Jew. Of course, he was of Yotzei Sfard descent. He also had, again, he had that whole trade connections between with all the different Sephardi people, all the different Sephardi Portuguese people all over the Mediterranean basin. Very, very wealthy person. He was a very well-meaning person who, even though he was very well-to-do, was very religious and tried to be very parush, and tried to exercise asceticism, etc., etc., supported Talmidei Chachamim. He was a well-meaning person with Tal Yosef. Where he fell in the end of the Shabtai Tzvi story, I'm not sure. I'm mamish not sure. I don't think it's like more. I'm more historically curious than it's really not that important. I would feel, you know what I mean? Someone like this doesn't really know much. You know, I mean, he knew something, but he was not a real. He wasn't the Talmud Chacham of stature. Now, when Shabtai Tzvi went to Alexandria, he made a very positive impression on Rafael Yosef. Quotes the Ghibli. And that sets the stage for the next part of what happens. So he went into Alexandria, because that was really the Mahalach. In other words, I know you're going to say, if you see someone coming from Salonika or Aleppo, you're going to say, if they want to go to Israel, they should just go down the coast. Right? That's what you would think. But that's not how it was usually done. Usually, if you wanted to go to Israel, you went into Egypt and then up to Israel. That's how it was done. That was like the norm. You had people went straight to Israel, to Palestine, Israel, Palestine. But it was very normal to go through Egypt to Israel. Okay, so that's what Shabtai Tzvi does. In Alexandria, he meets Rafael Yosef, the Ghibli, makes a very positive impression. He goes from there to Yerushalayim. He spends about 2 years in Yerushalayim. Unfortunately, I didn't have my real book on it, Gershon Shalom's book, and I can't find my notes. And I told you Wikipedia messed this whole part of the story up. They didn't think this was an important detail. I think it's a very important. This is from the most critical parts of all the details of the whole Shabtai Tzvi story. He comes to Yerushalayim, and it's a repeat. Unfortunately, I don't remember what manic acts he does, but he comes in. He knows something. Nigla Nister. He knows something about regular Torah and hidden Torah. Makes a positive impression on the rabbis, but then he goes up and does something wild. And they don't put him into Cherem, but they're like, they could see the guy, something's wrong with the guy. And they push him away a little. Then he left, he comes back, and a second time they're in the middle of typical problem in those times, which is the Jewish community in Jerusalem has severe problems, and with that, they decide to ask him to be a shliach to go to Egypt to collect money from Rafael Yosef. Because they know he has a connection. Even though they know he's not completely stable, they do know they're not worried about anything. In other words, he was viewed most likely by most Rabbanim as a harmless, unstable person. So they say, look, we need money. Go back to Egypt. But he was charismatic. He had a nice personality. Go back and see what you could do. So that's where we're going to stop here. He goes back to Egypt to see what he can do. And he was actually successful. But we're going to leave the story there and get to the meat of the story next week. I hope we should be able to get through the whole story next week. Fine. I'll come for this week, guys.